Pamela Koloff, thank you for talking to Reason.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, so your new book, Catch the Devil, which I read very quickly, it's very difficult to put down, is about something that I think a lot of people will not have read much about. It's about one of the most prolific jailhouse snitches in American history, whose now discredited testimony put a lot of people in prison and on death row, including one person whom a lot of people, I think across the political aisle, would agree is likely innocent. This man, Paul Skolnick, posed as an executive at Southwest Airlines in the beginning of the book, a high power attorney, a Vietnam War hero, an informant for the FBI, and as well as a terminally ill cancer patient, to you directly.
Correct.
So I know this question to start is very broad, but I want to ask how it is possible for someone with such an intense history of dishonesty to still earn the state's trust for decades.
I think you hit upon the big question of the book, right? Like in the early days of what Skolnick did, and let me quickly explain what his sort of get out of jail free card was. So he sort of started off as a small time con artist, first in Texas, then moved to Florida. And he was brazen enough that he didn't use pseudonyms. He went under his real name. And so he would get caught and he would be arrested, but he had this sort of fearless attitude about it because he knew that whenever he ended up in jail, he was a former police officer himself, so he sort of knew how the game worked. He knew that when he got to whatever county jail he ended up in, he could size up whoever it was that prosecutors, you know, most wanted a conviction against. Most people in jail are pre-trial. They have not gone to trial or taken a plea yet, as you well know. And then he would go to police and prosecutors and he would say, that guy in the cell next to me just confessed his crime to me. And he would produce these incredible, quote unquote, confessions. And in return for his testimony about those confessions, he would usually be let free. So going back to your question, I think, you know, early on, you can imagine how perhaps there were police and prosecutors who bought this. I think what becomes more difficult as you see his work go on through this book is as he becomes used more and more widely in this one county in Florida where he helped to send upwards of 40 men to prison. At what point does someone say, what are the odds that this guy in the jail has a better batting record than like our best detectives? No one ever says that. And at the same time, he is asked to testify in increasingly consequential cases. He started off doing sort of low-level drug crime type cases and eventually ends up testifying in capital cases in which the death penalty is in play.
You know, after he obtains his freedom in these cases where he's offered leniency in exchange for his testimony, he gets out.
Parts of this book are darkly funny. Like it's very dark, to be clear, but he's so over the top that there are areas in which it's okay to laugh.
It's cartoonish.
Cartoonish, exactly.
But he will leave jail and occasionally prison when he actually does serve a prison time and immediately pick back up on his life of crime. Can you talk a little bit about that and how over the course of many decades, it's not as if he showed the state that he was a changed man. So can you talk a little bit about his intense record of crime over the years?
Yes. When I caught up to him in 2018, when he was in federal prison, he had a rap sheet that was, I think, the longest of any rap sheet of anyone I've ever interviewed, which is saying something. he had really begun in the early 70s, again, with these small-time crimes, you know, writing hot checks, and escalated. And the crimes, you know, sometimes he would be released from jail on his own reconnaissance, which amazed me because he would never return. There was nothing trustworthy about him. And in fact, there's some interesting characters in the book of police officers who are sort of charged with making sure he returns to court to give his promised testimony. But he had this compulsive need. He couldn't live a normal life, really. He was always sort of living a lie. And one of the most interesting things is the way in which his crimes escalated as he came to understand that he was invincible because there weren't going to be consequences for him to face. I think the one that I found to be the most upsetting was he was released in 1982, and within a month of being released, he had sexually abused a 12-year-old girl. And because he was so valuable to police and prosecutors when that happened, that case was swept under the rug. It was not prosecuted. And my reporting involved trying to figure out who that 12-year-old girl was. Her name was redacted from the files I had. And I finally tracked her down and found her and explained to her that I had read everything in this case file and that there were two witness statements. There were two friends of hers that had seen part of what had happened and that it had been a prosecutable case. And I explained to her why that case had been made to go away. And, you know, she's now my age, but she always had to live with not being believed and making that go away. And I'll just add one other thing. The most incredible detail from that story, when Karen Parker, the 12-year-old girl, reported this crime, she was made to take a polygraph exam. A 12-year-old girl without her parents, with a male officer, gave her a polygraph exam. Skalnick, who testified in upwards of 40 cases, never was asked to take one. And I think that tells us a lot.
And I don't want to give away too much about the book, but I think one of the most disturbing things to me is he would go on to repeat the behavior that you just described. And it is a very, I mean, what was it like talking to Karen Parker, who has to know now that had that case been prosecuted and taken seriously? I forget in the book you outline how much prison time he would have faced, but I mean, sexually abusing a child comes with a hefty prison term that would have incapacitated him for quite a long time. What was that like, speaking with her?
So, you know, one of the things that was interesting about this book is really revisiting those women. Like, first of all, finding them. There were a lot of reporting challenges. Finding them, convincing them to talk to me after all these years. And when you arrive, as you know, when you arrive in someone's life after all these years, you don't know what you're walking into. Like, does her husband know this? Has she spoken to people about this? Has she buried this? Does she not want to think about this? So it was actually a great reporting lesson for me, because I tend to be on the shyer side with these things, that it's really important for people who the system has not worked for to feel like someone believes them and is listening to them. So it was interesting. She was so shocked, but also so relieved to know that she wasn't crazy, that she was believed, that everything was backed up in those files. But she was heartbroken to learn, because she didn't know until we spoke, that he had gone on to abuse another girl, a 16-year-old girl in Texas in the early 90s. And that woman, Misty Anderson, similarly did not know that anyone had been before her. When we look at Skelnick's punishments, you know, by the time he does this in the early 90s in Texas to Misty Anderson, he was treated as a first-time sexual offender, not as a repeat offender. Had he been punished the first time, would he even have been out in the world, you know, able to do that to Misty Anderson. So there, what I'm trying to show with all that is the collateral damage. Like, if you as a prosecutor believe, just as an example, that the title of the book comes from a quote that a prosecutor in the lead case I talk about gave me, where he, and I'm paraphrasing, but he essentially says, you have to work with a sinner to catch the devil. And in his mind, the sinner was Paul Skelnick, and the devil was this man in his sights who was sent to death row, who I think my book shows did not commit the crime he's there for. But when that's your goal, when your goal is to, quote unquote, catch the devil, you, I think, can lose sight of what is lost along the way. When you depend on someone like Paul Skelnick, you are allowing so many other harms to happen.
I want to talk about the case at the center of the book that you just mentioned. I mean, as we're discussing, the case covers, or the book covers, a lot of disturbing cases, but the one that is central to it is a murder case in Florida. Can you talk a little bit about, can you just kind of set the scene for us, what this man was accused of, and how it played out in court?
Sure. So there was a terrible murder in 1985 in Pinellas County, Florida, which is on the Gulf Coast, in a town called Indian Rocks Beach. And there was a 14-year-old girl named Shelley Boggio whose body was found in a body of water. She'd been stabbed over 30 times, and the assumption was that she'd been sexually assaulted. There was very little evidence because she was in the water. The investigation quickly narrows down to a man named Jack Piercy, who had a long history of violence against women and had been involved in a murder-for-hire case in Missouri a few years earlier. And he has fled the state. He talks about having blood on his shoes that night. He was the last person seen with Shelley Boggio. When he is interviewed by investigators, he realizes they know too much for me to claim that, like, I don't know anything about this and I wasn't there. So what he pivots to is saying that he had his housemate, this man, Jim Daly, with him that night, and that it was Jim, you know, he stayed in the car, and that it was Jim who committed this crime. There are so many things, as you can see in the book, that don't make sense about this. Jack Piercy had been trying to get alone with this girl for a long time and was very interested in her. Why he would bring a friend along doesn't make a lot of sense. Jim did not have that kind of record. And there's no physical or forensic evidence tying him to the crime or any motive whatsoever. But long story short, Jack Piercy is tried. He's found guilty, but he gets a life sentence. He doesn't get death. And Jim is tried after him. And at that era in Pinellas County, Florida, to have a case like that, that wasn't, where prosecutors had failed to get a death sentence, was unacceptable, really, in the tough on crime
era. It was a political problem.
It was a huge political problem, exactly. And so Skelnick is brought in at the last minute, very shortly before the trial starts. Skelnick was moved in the jail to be close to where Jim Daly was. And within 24 hours, he says that he has procured Jim Daly's confession, a total stranger who's awaiting trial. And this incredible testimony is put on at Jim's trial. And Skelnick gives this, it's not just that Skelnick says that Jim confessed to him. It's this incendiary story he tells. It's the kind of story that, it's why prosecutors, you know, liked working with him. It was a story that really played upon jurors' sympathies. He talked about how Jim Daly had supposedly told him about stabbing Shelley Boggio to death and how she'd been staring at him in this sort of pleading way, but she wouldn't die. And so it's this horrific image, and he's sentenced to death.
The book very convincingly makes the case that it is implausible that he actually did this. I know, I think a lot of people roll their eyes these days when they hear about wrongful convictions because, I mean, you know, everyone behind bars, not everyone, but a lot of people behind bars claim they're innocent. What makes you think he actually is?
So I started my career in the 90s, sort of along the same time as the advent of DNA analysis. And I remember in that time, in the mid to late 90s, the idea that there could be an innocent person who's on death row seemed pretty implausible.
Right.
From where we sit now, just one statistic for folks who doubt this kind of thing that has really shocked me is, I believe when I looked at the National Registry of Exonerations, this was about a month ago for a story I was working on, since the early 70s, there have been over 200 people in the U.S. who had been sentenced to death who have since been exonerated. In my mind, that's an error rate. That, I mean, you could argue that one person is an error rate too many, but over 200, I think, shows this is a feature, not a bug of the system. And we know that jailhouse informants, who are notoriously unreliable, are a factor in 25% of those wrongful convictions. So I just wanted to mention that as in the broad scope of things. As far as Jim's case, there's no there. There were three jailhouse informants they ended up putting on in this case. And I think that's really all you need to know about the strength of the state's evidence against him. I found that one jailhouse informant is a huge red flag for any case. Doesn't necessarily mean the defendant is innocent. It might mean the evidence is weak or prosecutors are seeking, you know, too harsh of a punishment for what the crime is, but there's something wrong with the case. When you see a case with three jailhouse informants, no physical evidence, no motive, and your quote unquote eyewitness is the main suspect in the case, I think there are a lot of questions there.
One of the things that I thought was very interesting, you describe in the book the spatial logistics of how Paul Skalnick would have had to, like the route he would have had to take to the jail to elicit this confession. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so many people have asked me, you know, how did this guy survive in prison? You know, snitches get stitches is the
same.
And
for listeners, by this point in Skalnick's career, as a jailhouse informant, everyone knew who he was.
Exactly. So he's widely known in the jail as a jailhouse informant. He's in protective custody by 1987, by the time he supposedly elicits this confession from Jim Daly. So when he wants to go to the rec yard or he needs to take a shower, he has to be accompanied by a correctional officer. So the story that the state, you know, put on and asked jurors to believe is that Skalnick, with a correctional officer walking with him past Jim Daly's cell, and I'm smiling, it's so awful, but I'm smiling because it's so preposterous, that walking past Jim's cell, Jim might say, "Hey, you know what? I did it, and here's what happened." And I think it's easy for us to look back at this, especially in that time period, and just think, like, how is it possible for a jury to believe testimony like that? So two things are really important to remember. One is that whenever a jailhouse informant is put on the stand, they're sponsored by prosecutors. So jurors have seen, let's say, the first witness in the case is maybe the lead investigator in the case, like who was at the crime scene, you know, usually a credible witness. Maybe the second person is a paramedic who was there, or the medical examiner. So someone like Paul Skalnick is put in that mix. And the prosecutor, by putting him on the stand, is vouching for his credibility. And in fact, they spent a lot of time on that with him on the stand, with him saying he hadn't been promised anything in return. Right. So I think I think there's that. I think there's also the quality of defense representation. You know, if you have no time and you have no money, as was even more often the case back then, you can't assemble, you can't go into all the different cases in this county. How do you even find all the cases that this man has been involved in? How do you put together your, you know, you have so much other evidence to deal with. This is one witness of, you know, 20. So a lot of his claims weren't really properly challenged on the stand.
One of the things that sticks out to me as you're going through Jim Daly's case specifically is the number of procedural hurdles that stand in the way to, because the book is obviously about Paul Skalnick and jailhouse snitchery, but to me, the secondary theme was that when there was credible evidence, or at least reasonable doubt, we'll say, that someone actually committed a crime after a jury has rendered a verdict, it is depressingly difficult to get another chance. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
Thank you so much for highlighting that. I am sort of obsessed with this idea that the system is built to compound its own errors. And that's what I was trying to show. There's part of the book, you follow Jim Daly's case through his appeals and post-conviction work. And you can see, I think someone who isn't immersed in this world would believe that when new evidence comes out, and there's a lot of new evidence that comes out over the years in this case that really points towards his innocence, that you would think that would be enough. And what you see is that, you know, for some very good reasons, a jury verdict is sacrosanct. It is, you know, jurors have heard live testimony. They've been able to observe the witnesses in a way that from a cold transcript you can't. And there's a lot of value put on that by appellate courts. But what you see as this moves through the courts is that courts really look backward at precedent and jury verdicts rather than forward at new evidence, at, you know, this didn't come into play in this case, but things like developments in forensic science and things like that. And Jim gets terrific attorneys in this case too late. And they do incredible work, and it doesn't matter. It's too late. Too many judges have sort of rubber stamped this testimony by Paul Skalnick at that point.
Right, because at one point, either one judge or a couple of judges say something like, they imply that it's compelling, but they essentially say too much time has passed.
Yes, the term time barred comes up a lot. You know, that the quickest way I can explain that to folks who are not steeped in this is that you can find exculpatory evidence, but if it's at a very late juncture in a case, it can often be too late. And there are reasons for this that do make sense in the abstract. The idea is, hey, we can't have people endlessly appealing their cases. And, you know, in death penalty cases, you're afforded more opportunities for that. We can't keep putting victims' families through this. We can't put the strain on the system, which I understand. But it seems to me that when you have this much evidence at this point, that there's no way for the courts to essentially say, hey, let's take a time out. Let's go back and like look at this holistically and see if any of this makes sense. It was shocking to me to see that in the reporting for this book.
You talked earlier about the conversations you had with many of the people who appear in the book. What was it like meeting Jim himself?
So we had very, very little time. I did a lot of the reporting for this book during the pandemic when I could not go see him. So I met him back in 2019 when I was working on a magazine story for the New York Times Magazine and ProPublica that this book grew out of. And we had 1 hour to cover 40 years of his case. One thing that stood out to me And I think this is how he has survived all these years was, you know, I had a photographer with me. We had to get a photo of him for the cover of the magazine. And we had to ask him to stop smiling because his smiling did not match the tone of the story. And I mention that because he, again, I won't give too much away, but though he remains on death row at the age of 80, he has kept alive all these years, outlived most people in this case, by these very deep emotional bonds to people, by appreciating these very small moments in life. He paints, he's an incredible artist, and he reads, and he you know, still sees the love of his life, his ex-wife who's now back in his life. And I was so struck by that, that here was somebody who he had just gotten a stay of execution, but like a few days earlier when I went to see him, he had still had an execution date. But that was how he kept going, was he was happy that we were there writing about his case. And I was so struck by that, as opposed to Skalnick, who is a very different personality.
Right. The end of the book, which I will not give away.
And I should add one thing just to make clear that that wasn't my only communication with Jim Daly. We had a long epistolary, many, many, many letters sent back and forth. And another great reporting lesson I learned from that is that the best material I got on him wasn't from him. It was from the men he'd served in Vietnam with, from his daughter, from people who knew him really well, from his pen pal in the Netherlands who excavated 20 plus years of letters for me. So that was what a lot of that was drawn from. Sorry to have interrupted you.
Oh, you're good. I was just going to say that the end of the book, which I will not give away, but the description of, you know, his life had me weeping at a coffee shop, which I should not admit, but it makes me verklempt even thinking about it now. It was so well done.
Thank you.
Juxtaposing that with Paul Skalnick, whom in the beginning of the book you allude to the fact that you're like unsure if he's also taking you for a ride. Because
right.
He is himself. I mean, obviously his deception was not limited to courtrooms. And so I'm hoping you can talk about kind of how you approach that over the years that you tried to interact with this elusive person, how you decided what was real and what wasn't.
So I love nothing more than an unreliable narrator. I mean, to me, that's just the most, right? That's the most fascinating type of person we can write about. Luckily, you know, I have fact checkers and things to help me along the way. But my first meeting with him was in federal prison in 2018. He'd not been able to talk his way out of that one. But it was so interesting. In our first meeting, he told me things that were obviously lies from the get-go, such as he produced this Xeroxed copy of a photo of his 100-foot-long yacht that he owned, that he kept in Belize, I think it was. And he talked about his offshore accounts in the Cayman Islands. And he told me that he was dying of cancer, and he produced this bloody rag that was supposed to be evidence of that. And obviously all of that was false, and I knew that to be false, and I think maybe he knew I knew that to be false. It was this strange performance. But he also knew what I was hungry for when I came there, which is that I wanted him to talk to me. I wanted a story. And I knew that he was the key to that, that if I could get him here supposedly at the end of his life to tell me everything that he had done, that I could write this incredible piece. And so that's what he promised me. He said in that meeting, you know, this is the time to tell the story. You're the person to tell it. Let's do this. We came up with this game plan where I was going to go back and visit him frequently. We were going to communicate via the prison email. I was so excited and thrilled that I had gotten like the story of the century, I thought, and elated, you know, I was elated and called my editor on the way back to Austin and told her that he was going to work with me. And it wasn't until months later when, you know, I hadn't been able to get another visit with him because he didn't feel well enough to meet me, or he hadn't written back to me because, you know, oh, my questions must not have arrived at the mailroom. And he was carrying on this very charming and interesting correspondence with me at the same time, but he wasn't telling me anything. And so I realized months into this that like he had done the same thing to me that he'd done to everybody else. And I thought it was an important place to start the book, like just in case anyone feels like, well, I would never be taken in by someone like this. The people in this book must not be as smart as me. It was like, I'm an investigative reporter. I knew he was a con artist and still. But I'll just say as a last thing, that's what set this whole thing in motion. Because at that point, I was pissed. I was like, I have put so much time and I had done so much research, you know, into this case. Like, if he's not going to tell me what happened, I'll go piece it together myself.
Was he charming?
He was
like, when you walk in, what is his vibe? You know what I mean?
He was very charming. I feel like this is one thing I wish I had described this better from my own perspective. I describe other people finding him charming, but he, you know, even knowing all these terrible things he had done, he was delightful to talk to. And I think one of the things
That's fascinating.
Well, I was reflecting it. So he was married 9 times that I know of. I think there were probably more. And one of the reasons I think women loved him is he was a fantastic listener. He was like a very active listener in a way that I think, you know, divorced women or women who had been unlucky in love really responded to. And he could talk about anything and everything. And he told these stories of, like, you felt like if you spent time with him, life was not going to be boring. And I think it was very appealing. And I enjoyed speaking to him myself, even knowing all the terrible things he had done.
Out of all the people you spoke to for the book, was there anyone who surprised you? And, you know, you mentioned earlier going and talking to a lot of these people and being a little apprehensive or cautious, rather. Was there anyone who really resented you reaching out? I was thinking about this before the interview after reading the book, and I was like, I'm trying to put myself in the shoes of these women, right? You mentioned he's married at least 9 times, sometimes simultaneously, I think.
Yes, he was a big
I don't know if that's legal, but he had 9 women who thought they were married. I know I would feel really silly and embarrassed. I'm not saying that that's rational or that they should, because it's not their fault. But if you came to me and said, Billy, this person who you were married to really took you for a ride, let's talk about it for the New York Times plus this, but I would be like, oh my gosh, I don't think I can do that. So did you have anyone that really surprised you or was like, I just can't go there?
Yes. So they kind of fell into 2 camps. If we just talk about the women, the ex-wives themselves, the no's I got on this were the strongest no's I've ever received on any story. I mean, there was one email I received that will haunt me for the rest of my life about how just reaching out to this person had.
Right. Which, and just for, I don't mean to interrupt you, but for context, we should add that he stole from a lot of his wives and and ruined their lives in some ways.
Yeah. So sorry, just to explain. So it wasn't just that he, for example, told one woman I interviewed that the entire time they'd been married, he was in law school and he kept up this crazy charade with like law books all over their living room. And he's always disappearing to do mock trial and none of it was true. It wasn't just that. It was that he would completely clean them out financially and ruin them for years. I mean, these are women who are trying to make it on their own and their credits destroyed on top of having all their money taken. And then, you know, several of them, their daughters were abused by him. So the no's I got were haunting, really, like, that's not too strong of a word, of the pain that people were still in. Of the people who did agree to speak to me, and again, this was a good lesson for me, most of them thought they were the only one, like that they were the Rube who had believed this story. Or, you know, maybe there was one other person. When I'm able to show them, okay, just as an example, there was a woman when I was working, when I was doing my reporting on this, who was engaged to Skelnik, this woman, Donna Mackey. She was totally in love with him. She had built up this, she was very excited about the life they were going to have when he was released from prison, when they were going to go live in Belize and, you know, ride around on the yacht and all these things. And to be clear, his descriptions of these things, it's almost unbelievable that he didn't actually see them. They were so vivid. So I didn't know what my responsibility was as a reporter. I was getting information from her. I didn't know if she was feeding information to him. It was very complicated. And it wasn't until Donna called me very excitedly telling me that Skelnik was being released from prison. And she was so excited because he was going to come live with her before they moved to Belize. And he was so excited to meet her 6-year-old granddaughter. And when she said those words, I said, Donna, I need to come see you tomorrow. Can I please come see you tomorrow? And drove 5 hours to East Texas with my car full of every record I had from my reporting and laid out for her who he was. And that was really tough. But at the end of the day, she was glad to, you know, have that information and cut off things with him.
How did you kind of balance in a situation like that the expectations between being a reporter and just, you know, getting the story versus like almost, that's like almost like you're her therapist for a moment or and a friend. What was that like?
I think the lines definitely in that situation definitely got blurred because at that point, you know, if I show her everything, then I know she can tell Skelnik all of that and show him all those things. And I hadn't published anything yet. But I just, to me in this work, there's like the gut check. And I mean, there was no other choice. Like what could I do? I couldn't let him move into her house with her granddaughter. Like that's just not an option. Right. So I think that was one of the interesting things about this book was the ethics of the reporting of it in issues like this, where you become enmeshed in someone's life to a certain degree. But in that case, there was nothing else I could do.
You know, thinking about some of the stories you told, it becomes clear at certain points, I think, that law enforcement knew they had someone deeply dishonest. And so I want to get your thoughts on the psychological process of why you think they were still so desperate to trust him. We touched on it a little bit earlier when you were talking about the Catch the Devil quote. But what I want to hear more on is if you think, I don't like making bad faith arguments, but if you think they really believed it to be true out of, like, you know, the power of denial being very strong and wanting to deny in their minds that this was a bad egg, or if you think they did kind of know that he was full of shit and still proceeded with all of these cases.
So I handle that very delicately in the book, I think, because we don't know the answer. I'll give you my thoughts on that in a second, but the lead investigator in Jim Daly's case would not speak to me. This is John Halliday. And just quickly for reference, Halliday worked with Skelnik for years. And part of something he regularly did in cases is he would go to the Pinellas County Jail and pull guys out of their cells and say, what do you know about this case? And, you know, guys knew what that meant. That meant that there was the possibility, you know, information was needed and maybe they would be treated favorably in return if they gave it. But I think I truly do think that the investigator in this case and the prosecutors believe that Jim committed this crime. I think what I hope the book shows is how tunnel vision and some early bad decisions in an investigation, and it's important for people to recognize that prosecutors inherit an investigation, right? They inherit all the biases in that investigation. They still have a duty to look more deeply, but there can be decisions made early on that can change so much. And I remember just like my jaw being on the floor when I came across this testimony of another key investigator in the case. I can't remember if it was at Jack Piercy's trial or Jim Daly's trial, but he said that he had just always known that this was a two-man crime. And the defense attorney who's cross-examining him, you know, later presses him on this. Like, well, what did you see at the crime scene? Like, what are you talking about that you knew it was a two-man crime? Because this was, to be clear, like, whatever evidence there was washed away. And he said it just was a feeling that he had. And I think things like that, you know, lead you in really bad directions.
More broadly, do you think this is still a problem today? Is this kind of the thing, this kind of something that is just a very dramatic example that can never be replicated? Do you think that this is something people should still be worried about?
I think it's very much still in play today. I think there are things about it that have gotten harder, you know, now that we have the internet. It's easier to track people and what they're doing. However, we have the death of newspapers. So I was able to go back and find so many of the cases he had testified in, not just through court records, which took a lot of time, but through media coverage. In fact, that's how I figured out that he began, that Skelnick began his jailhouse informant career in Texas, not Florida. There was this extremely obscure communist newspaper that had covered, it's a long story, that had covered this trial in Houston. So it still very much is in play. There are small reforms in a few states that sort of nibble at the edges of this. Illinois requires something called reliability hearings, pretrial. Texas is experimenting with having registries for jailhouse informants, but that's county by county within right. one state. I think these reforms have good intentions, but I don't think they address the root problem whatsoever. And to me, it's absolutely incredible that we can have what we call incentivized testimony, someone who thinks, even if it's never been spoken by a prosecutor or police officer, that they'll be rewarded for their testimony, someone who never actually witnessed the crime themselves, that they're allowed to give their testimony in cases, and especially capital cases.
You mentioned press coverage. One of the questions I had on my list, I was fascinated by some of the press coverage you cite, so much so that I started going to read the articles myself. Like you reference one, I think it was, I don't want to say the wrong one, maybe the Tampa Bay Times.
So the reason you paused is it was the St. Petersburg Times at the time.
Okay. Yes. Which is right south of Tampa.
But it's now Tampa.
So when I found the article, it was the Tampa Bay Times.
Exactly.
And just looking at how, I mean, this isn't necessarily central to the book, but looking at how the press coverage of crimes like that, I mean, this was a 14-year-old girl who was murdered. And talk a little bit about that, because it was a little shocking.
I'm so happy that you were inspired to look at newspapers.com, which really should be like a sponsor of this book. So Shelley Boggio, the victim of the central crime that we talked about, who was murdered, you know, the way that she was covered in the paper, and to be clear, the newspaper coverage by and large then, and that paper, like, I'm not sure I could have written this book without all the incredible court reporters, like newspaper reporters covering the courts. without the work that they had done. And that paper, by and large, did and still does incredible work. I just want to make sure to say that. But there's one unfortunate story about Shelley after she dies, and the way that she's written about, it's almost as if the message is like, hey, girls, if you do what Shelley did, like, this is what happens to you.
Right. And, she had it coming kind of thing.
Yeah, that's the subtext, I think, of that article. The article is about how attractive she was. This is a 14-year-old girl.
14, yeah.
How she didn't go to school very often, how she was a bad girl. I want to put that in quotes. I don't agree with that assessment. She was someone who was precocious and adventurous.
And she also had a difficult home life. Like, it was not a conventional upbringing.
She had a very, her mother was not in her life. Her father had uprooted her and her sisters and brought them from Michigan to Florida, where they knew no one. And it was so of another time. And again, I was a teenage girl in the 80s, and I remember press coverage of cases like this. I remember the focus on what rape victims were wearing at the time of, you know, sexual assaults and all these things. But there was something so shocking to just go back and like see it from today's vantage point, you know?
Yeah, it was absolutely fascinating. Your book and your work broadly requires an insane amount of research. And so I'm hoping you can talk about your process, how you go about that. Are you going to see these people in person? How do you have the time to go through thousands and thousands of pages? I mean, how do you even begin to take on such a daunting task of piecing all these things together?
So in this case, I had the benefit of something that many of the defense attorneys who were trying to help their clients when Skelnick was on the stand didn't have. And that is a woman named Laura Fernandez, who was working at a white shoe law firm in the early 2010s. She was part of a team that was trying to help get a man who was on death row named Richard Cooper. He was on death row in Florida. They were trying to see if they could get a life sentence for him and overturn his death sentence. And they ended up succeeding in that. Skelnick had been a witness against him. And so Laura started digging in to who Skelnick was. And I've never really met anyone like Laura before in terms of like the doggedness with which she pursues things. But the key is not just her doggedness. It's that she had the backing of a big law firm that wanted her to be doing 24/7 pro bono work. And she dug into this for years. So when I first encountered her in 2018, she had a 100-page timeline of Skelnick's antics and movements over the years. I've since built that out to something like 260 pages, and that's through over 100 public record requests and all these things. And I think that work, I mean, I'm lucky enough to work at a place like ProPublica and the Times Magazine. In particular, ProPublica really values that kind of time and digging. But I think it just goes to show, I mean, it took me 5 years to do this book on top of a year of magazine reporting, on top of years and years of Laura's work. So when a defense attorney has someone like Skelnick on the stand, and they have the limited time and resources they have to try to discredit him, it's almost impossible. You don't have this treasure trove to refer to.
Can you respond to someone who hears about a story like this and says, well, this is just about, you know, one man?
Mm-hmm. I think every story I write, you know, it focuses very deeply on one case or one individual. But what I hope it shows is the systemic ways in which this is all part of a larger story. Like, to me, at the end of the book, and I basically say this, Paul Skelnick isn't the villain of this story. The villain of the story is elements of the criminal justice system, the incentives that exist within the criminal justice system, the incentives for an elected state attorney who's has to get, you know, a death sentence, the incentives for prosecutors to win their cases, the incentives for detectives to close a case. And those things are universal. They go so far beyond this one set of circumstances in this one county in Florida. And I think, I hope that the book really makes people think more deeply about that.
I want to talk a little bit about you and your life generally. So you mentioned you work at the Times and ProPublica. How did you get your start? You said you started in the 90s?
So I started, I briefly wrote for a trade magazine called Texas Highway Patrol Magazine, which we do not need to dwell upon. I ghost wrote a column called Ask the Officer. And that was back in...
Okay, I'm looking forward to your memoir.
That was back in the day of stringing together any and every bit of freelance work I possibly could. And I lucked into a staff writing job when I was 25 at a magazine called Texas Monthly, which some people may be familiar with. It's like the Vanity Fair of Texas. It does incredible crime reporting in particular.
They do, yeah. As a former Dallasite, I think a lot of their work is really fabulous.
It's an incredible place. I was there for 20 years. But, coming there in the 90s, in the late 90s, when Texas was executing more people than has ever happened in American history, there was sort of no way to be in Texas and at a place where these true crime practitioners like Skip Hollandsworth and Gary Cartwright were plying their trade and not do this. So I steered pretty hard into crime and criminal justice and ended up writing some stories that caused change in Texas, which was deeply satisfying. There was a man who had received a death sentence who was later exonerated in part because of a story I wrote, some legislation that was passed. And so for me, it was deeply satisfying to feel like I could occasionally try to make things change in my very messed up but beloved state of Texas. And in 2017, I joined ProPublica and the Times Magazine. My former boss, Jake Silverstein, who was the editor-in-chief of Texas Monthly for a number of years, had gone to the Times Magazine. And the job that I have, which is unique to me, I'll just quickly explain because I think it's kind of fascinating. But I'm split between both organizations, and everything I write is co-published by both organizations. But each publication has a really different mandate. So I have to find stories that have the investigative rigor and the public interest dimension of a ProPublica story, while also somehow having like the narrative storytelling and depth of a New York Times Magazine story. So it's a super easy job that does not cause me any stress whatsoever. No, but it's like, I feel like I'm edited by just the most amazing people, and I'm very lucky in the news landscape we're in.
How do you feel like magazine journalism has changed since going from, starting in the late 90s to 2026?
I am like the last person to complain about this because I write stories that are so serious, though this book does have moments of humor in it, as I said, but I miss the like whimsy and the fun of the 90s and early 2000s. There were a lot of not great things about magazine land back then, to be clear. It was a boys club and a white boys club, to be sure. But there were, with so many men's magazines, taking these like big swings, really being very experimental in terms of language and form. David Foster Wallace was writing a lot of magazine stories. I mean, like, it's almost hard to imagine now. And I feel like, I think one of the things that makes me sad about sort of 2016 on is this endless seriousness. You know, even when I was at Texas Monthly, I was a generalist. So I would write some incredibly depressing criminal justice story. And then I would go do a celebrity profile. And then I would go review a barbecue restaurant. And I would do a travel story to Mexico. And I feel like we've all, I actually think it's part of why we have such news exhaustion right now, why people aren't engaging with the news as much. We don't have that mix. And one of the things that's lost, sorry to sound so old here, with reading on our phones, when you get a magazine, somebody has curated a mix of stories for you. You have your hard-hitting investigation with your fluff. And
it's also artistic. It's interwoven with beautiful images.
It's you enjoy the experience and you go from mood to mood as you flip pages. And now, you know, with the algorithms and everything, we're just sort of fed the same thing over and over again.
How do you go about finding stories? You know, you say that you have this very strange hybrid that you're looking after. So what is your process to find a juicy story?
Okay, so I'm in a constant panic about what the next story is. I have a lot of different ways. I have an elaborate system of Google alerts on every single esoteric, bizarre thing that I'm interested in that I might ever want to write about. That hasn't really panned out, but I still have hope that it might one day. I talk to a lot of academics and practicing attorneys who obsess about the same things that I obsess about. I'm sure you do the same thing, but it's like every person I encounter is my possible portal to the next story. And so there is no one who I'm not chatting up in some way. And it's amazing, the things you find that way. I'm also really lucky, I think for the first time in my career, because of the platform I have, that people bring stories to me. That can also be really hard because these are amazing attorneys doing very important work, but it's not always something that works in magazine form.
How long do you spend on an average story?
So much longer than I am supposed to. I mean, I've spent years on and off on stories. Really, for a very in-depth story, it can be 6 to 8 months.
I feel like this is your thing. This is how I associate you. It's like Pam Koloff is the one who's really digging deep. And it's always amazing. For
yes.
The record.
Well, I mean, thank you. Sorry, I wasn't saying yes to that. Thank you for saying that. I am having to adapt. So I've seen my reading habits change along with everybody else's over the past 5 years. And when I started this job, I published a 21,000 word piece in 2 parts called Blood Will Tell that did very, very well, to be clear. I don't know if that story ran today, if it could find the audience that it did in 2018. So I'm thinking a lot about, I write shorter paragraphs than I used to. I write shorter stories than I used to. I turn stories around faster. I'm always thinking about the fact that, especially with something in the Times, that people are usually reading it on their phones and that I have to compete for their attention at every moment.
What is the juiciest thing you've published recently? Or what are you working on? You can choose to answer both or one.
So I just published, I think it was 2 weeks ago, a cover story in the New York Times Magazine, co-published with ProPublica, about what's going on in Florida. This is juicy, but I hate using the word juicy with this topic. But in the course of researching the book, I was, of course, tracking very carefully whenever dates for executions were being set, because Jim Daly is eligible right now. He's death warrant eligible. So I certainly took note in early 2025 when Ron DeSantis started signing this flurry of death warrants. And it's become so extreme that Florida this year has executed more men than all other states combined. Last year, Florida executed 40% of all people executed in the U.S. So my story both delves into that, but then really, because I write narrative stories and I hope that that's what brings people into a piece, I looked at the people on the ground who bear the brunt of that. I followed a priest who works with men on death row, walking them through their last days, and a number of other people. And it was really, really an incredibly moving story to work on.
What do you think about true crime? Would you describe Catch the Devil as true crime? Because I have an answer to that.
I really want to hear your answer first, and then I'll tell you mine. I have a lot of thoughts.
I came away, no, that it's not true crime.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like it was more like a literary, I thought it was like a really long magazine article. And I mean that as a compliment. Like I don't know, true crime has all of these associations and people feel some type of way about it. I guess I associate true crime with being less thorough and less interested in the policy implications, because this is also a policy book, just with like great prose. You know what I'm saying? How do you think of it?
You're making me so happy. So I wanted, you can see with the cover and the title, we're definitely steering into a true crime audience. And yet, I love that you used the word literary. That was definitely what I was aiming for. It's narrative nonfiction with sort of an investigative twist. And I think we all walk this careful line. Like, true crime is sort of the way that you can appeal to, I think, a very wide audience of people who might not ever have thought about criminal justice reform before, or might not ever have thought about what is not working in the system. And if you can use all the tools of that, of storytelling and, laying out who these characters are, I think it can bring people in more deeply. So I feel like I always walk this line between true crime and criminal justice writing, and neither one is right. It's like some other hybrid of it. I feel like, the person who's doing this at the highest possible level is Patrick Radden Keefe, and David Graham does it too. And yeah, I didn't want the book, and I'm so happy it's not, to be this like screed, right? Or to read like an academic paper in any way. I wanted it to be this propulsive, character-driven narrative.
Is the story finished? Do you think?
That is a great question. So I don't know. I mean, my hope is that with this book coming out, that more people come out of the woodwork. I am going to the belly of the beast on my book tour. I'm going to the Tampa area. I'm doing a lot of press there and a big event. And it would be my dream if someone came and said to me afterward, "Hey, can we go get coffee? I'd like to talk to you about this." I think there's so much more to tell.
Pamela Koloff, thank you for talking to Reason.
Thank you so much, Billy.